Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Welcome to Playback. The Dáil rose on Thursday for their summer recess, and with those cost of living measures on everyone's agenda, it was a tetchy end to the term, as we'll hear later. And all of this against the backdrop of the threats of increased tariffs from US President Donald Trump at the start of the week. 30% is the latest figure on the table, but how seriously should we take it? On Morning Ireland with Gavin, economics and public affairs editor David Murphy weighed up this question.
30%, the latest Trump threat. Does he mean it?
Well, I think many people have begun to judge Donald Trump by what he does rather than what he says. And if you look at what he says so far, he's previously threatened a 20% tariff on Europe. He's threatened a 50% tariff on Europe. He's changed the date from July the 9th to August the 1st. He previously backtracked on threats in April when markets took fright. So I think a lot of people will judge him now regarding what's going to be the outcome of the negotiations. And they are, in Europe, they're looking for a framework deal similar to what the UK has got. And I think that's going to be the big push by the EU diplomats over the next 2 weeks.
But what about us in all of this? Little old Ireland. With Claire on Tuesday, Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs.
Dan, how exposed is Ireland in all of this when we think about the potential for 30% tariffs? Are we the European country that will suffer the most if Donald Trump goes ahead with this one?
That very much depends on whether pharmaceuticals are included or not. But if we look at the amount per man, woman and child that we ship across the Atlantic to the United States, it's higher than any other country I can find in the world, not just in Europe. Germany, a famously big exporter to America, but also Canada and Mexico. So on a per person basis, our exports to the United States are extremely high, which means we're exposed. But Claire, if I may, just by some reassurance, I know there's been a bit of talk about how serious this could be, and it is extremely serious, going back to 2008 and the financial crisis. Financial crises are like a heart attack for an economy. They are very rapid onset, and they affect nearly every part of the economy. Now, what we're seeing here, again, is very serious, but it will not affect every single part of the economy. It will affect manufacturers that produce goods for the American market. That's very significant. It could lead to job losses that could spread wider into the economy. But it's not of the magnitude of a financial crisis that would be akin to a heart attack for the entire economy. Mm-hmm. So I think we just have some reassurance that we're not facing into a kind of 2008 situation. We're facing into much slower burn sort of sickness rather than the shock of 2008.
Still not great though, Dan. The way you describe it, you know, it mightn't be a heart attack, but it could be something just as serious, but it plays out over a longer period of time.
Indeed. And I think, you know, to be very honest with people, the difficulty with the situation is not just the 30% tariff, which, of course, may not happen. But equally, the Europeans are adamant that they have to respond or they will show signs of weaknesses and Trump will come back for more. So the risk is that we get into a tit for tat escalation. It won't be good for anyone. It'll be particularly bad for Ireland, given that we are so integrated into both the European and the US economies.
Eek. And at the very least, all of this uncertainty is creating an atmosphere of, well, caution. With Claire Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times.
This is all clearly feeding into the narrative now about budget 2026. And we know, and we've heard this so many times, there won't be any cost of living package this year. But it would seem, would you agree, that sentiment at government level is now more pessimistic than it had been up to this point?
Very much so. I think that the skies have been darkening in that respect in recent weeks and months within government. It's something that in private conversations, I hear regularly from people involved in the budget making process. And the The response from that within government is to look forward to a budget, I think, that will be a lot less generous in giveaway terms than the last three budgets. Government leaders have repeatedly said that there will be no package of one-off measures this year. We're told that those are not going to happen. Now, I do think that there will be significant political pressure for that position to be revisited before the budget. But certainly, if there is any package, I would envisage that it is an awful lot less. And we're also going to see, I think, a sharp decline in the growth in current spending that we've seen in recent years. That has been up 8-9% a year. I think that is likely to come down to somewhere near 5%. And, you know, people can talk about those numbers, and they sound sort of abstract, but what they mean is less money available to the government for increasing welfare rates, reducing taxes and so forth.
And as the Dáil took its summer break, leaders' questions brought us this exchange between Fine Gael's Simon Harris and Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty. And by the way, the Super Value bit, you'll hear it, that's Sinn Féin TDs incorrectly referring to Super Value as being US-owned. But it starts with Doherty asserting that since January, an extra 64,000 people couldn't pay their electricity bill.
That means for the first time that we have 300,000 households that cannot pay their electricity, 175,000 that can't pay the heating of their home in terms of gas. And you stand there as if you get it, you don't. What needs to happen is there needs to be a cost of living package in this year's budget. You need to bring forward energy credits. What you have said here, and what the signal that you've sent to those families who, under your government and under the previous government, can't pay their bills, is you're on your own. Energy credits have to be delivered in this year's budget. Otherwise, that is the signal and that is the message that you're sending them. There needs to be a cost of living package. And yes, yes, we understand there's instability, but there also was instability in the last number of years as well. We have a surplus at this point in time, and you're more happy to provide €186,000 to landlords in a tax credit than actually support people to heat their homes and keep the lights on.
If you genuinely think that this situation in relation to tariffs, trade, pharma, global uncertainty is the same as it was last summer, come on, you're better than that. You're better than that. You did. The record, though, you did. Now, let me. You spend a lot of your political career standing up here saying, you don't get it over here. You don't understand. You're out of touch. You know what I know? I know who owns SuperValue. And it's not an American multinational. I know who owns SuperValue. They sponsored the GAA. They sponsored the Tidy Towns. They're in towns and villages across the country. They're a proud Irish company. And you thought they were owned by an American multinational. And yet, you want Pascal Donoghue's job? You want Pascal Donoghue's job, and you don't even know who owns SuperValue or can't even use Google. Give me a break.
Scorchio. Well, on Thursday's News at One, Rachel put this to political correspondent Micheál Lehane.
Micheál, this Dáil started with chaos, really, over the position of Ceann Comhairle. How is it ending?
Well, it's ending really with a focus on the cost of living issue. The opposition united in their view that people really are struggling up and down the country, whether it comes to the price of food or the price of energy, as you heard there. But of course, the government has made that firm decision that there won't be any one-off measures anymore. Now, Jennifer Whitmore is saying that the government was essentially moralising in the lead-up to this budget, and she said the real reason, as she sees it, was the fact that there was no longer an election on the horizon. Of course, that rejected by the government, who pointed to things like the possibility of US tariffs being higher than anticipated, and also the future and questions around it of the pharmaceutical industry here. But I think there is no doubt that it was always going to be a challenge to end those cost of living one-off measures. And there is, amid all the uncertainty and amid all the fear, I think it does suit government on this, the last day of the Dáil, to point to that uncertainty as it faces into that challenge and now crafting the budget.
All eyes on that October budget, and in the meantime, those tariffs. And it was hard to get away from Donald Trump this week, especially if you tuned into Sunday with Miriam, with comedian and actor Rosie O'Donnell. She's a recent immigrant to Ireland and no friend of the current POTUS. This was how the interview started.
I was going to start gently this morning, finding out about your family, your path into comedy. But yesterday, the President of the United States of America, where you were born and raised,
yes, indeed,
threatened to take away your citizenship. How do you react to that?
Well, I reacted with a little post that I jotted off in 5 minutes, and that's been getting a lot of attention online. But, you know, this guy is a danger to the world. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I told the truth about him on a show called The View, which is similar to Loose Women, where women get together, four women or five, and talk about politics and current events. And he had just had a press conference for the Miss Teen USA from his pageant, who had been caught in the village kissing a girl. And the Daily News and the New York Post put a picture of her on the cover, and he was furious. And so he had her crying on TV, apologizing to America for, I guess, embarrassing him. And it looked very much to me like a pimp with his prostitute. So we were live 5 minutes after, and that was a topic. And I simply told the truth about who he is as a person. Facts, no lies, no hyperbole, just facts. And he went crazy. That was 2006, and he still uses me as a punching bag and a way to sort of rile his base. And I am very proud to be opposed to every single thing he says and does and represents. I think he's a racist, and he's misogynistic, and he's sexist, and he is a danger to women and children all over the world.
Definitely not a fan. But not every listener appreciated her views.
Harriet, however, says, "Miriam, I love your show, but Rosie does not represent the average American citizen, nor even the average Democrat. She's going for the usual attacks against calling President Trump a racist, etc. Tell the lie often enough, people start to believe it. If she cares so much for her country, why is she here? If the Democrats did such a good job, how come they lost their base?"
I didn't say the Democrats did such a good job, number one. Oh. And number two, he is a racist, and you can see that all his attacks now are on brown people. What I would say is the reason I moved was self-preservation. I needed to keep myself healthy and alive and mentally stable enough to raise an autistic child. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason I left. I left because I love the United States of America, not because I don't.
And they did talk a lot about Trump, but they also talked about O'Donnell's family, and in particular, her mother.
She was very funny, my mother. She was very much community activated. She was the head of the parish council at Christ the King. She was the president of the Parent Teacher Association in our school, Rolling Hills Elementary School. She was the Girl Scout leader. She was very involved, and she was an only child. And she got sick in like November of 1972 and died on St. Patrick's Day, 1973, 4 days before my 11th birthday. And that was the defining moment of my life. It was as if the color was sucked out like a reverse Wizard of Oz, right? First Dorothy singing over the rainbow, and the next thing you're in Kansas with a dead mother and no ruby slippers. And you think to yourself, whose life is this and how do I go on?
And she talked about spending time with her mother when she was dying.
She lay on the green couch in our nice living room where nobody ever was, and she made sure to put old sheets on the couch so as she wouldn't ruin it. And we would come in one at a time and have conversations with her. I remember she taught me how to use a dictionary. I was confused about how to find the word. I'd like just go to the letter B looking for beautiful and just keep looking. I didn't realize the letters were in order. And so she taught me that. But very sadly, the last thing she said to me was when we were doing that dictionary learning and I leaned in to get closer to her, to the couch. I was sitting on the floor and she said, "Careful, Roseanne, careful," because I had hit her suture. And the day after that, she went to the hospital and then we never saw her again.
And after her mother's death, her father didn't want it mentioned at all in the house.
The word mommy was never mentioned. The word mother, you would just skip it. If someone called on the phone and said, "Is your mom home?" we'd say she's at the store or she's in the shower. Because I didn't really believe that she had died, because my father took my little sister and I to the wake, and it was an open casket. And it was jam-packed with people. And we went up to the body, and my sister said, loud enough for people to hear, "Is Mommy sleeping?" Everyone started crying and yelling, and my father whisked us out, drove us home, and said, "You're not going to the funeral." And so I never went to the funeral, so I didn't have that kind of final closure. I didn't have the whole mass, and I know mass was vitally important to her. We went to mass every Sunday, and after she died, we went back one time, and you know how in church they say, and for those in our parish who have passed away, especially, and then they'd say the name, they said Roseanne O'Donnell, and my brother Danny started crying, and then everyone started crying, and then my father whisked us out, and we never went back to church.
And later in the interview, Miriam asked Rosie this question.
Do you think you would be as successful as you are if your mom hadn't died of breast cancer when you were so young? Or is that impossible to know? I mean,
I think it's impossible to know, but I feel strongly that I wouldn't be a performer. Mm-hmm. I think people who are performers are dying for some sort of love that they lost in some way, and there's an unfulfillable hole. And, you know, it can feel like love, mass adulation from the multitudes, but it's not. It's something different. And what you're craving is only found in family and in humanity and in interactions, in compassion and empathy. That's where you find the meaning of your life, not in how much money you have or how many fans are on your Facebook or whatever.
The very charming Rosie O'Donnell on Sunday with Miriam. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Liveline, this week with Colma Mungon, a lot of topics all week long. But what had started on Monday was still going by Thursday. We're talking about toilets, the state of, and what to do when you've got to go. A man got out of a car and headed for Áine's hedge.
We attempted to open the window and go, "Get the hell away from my hedge there."
Well, you know, you have to be so careful.
I know.
You know, you do that, and I certainly didn't recognise him from around, but you still, you're kind of a target if you do that.
Mm.
It's such a difficult thing, you know, because
well, you're probably
horrible.
A bit shocked as well in the beginning. So, I mean, you know, let's say the average urination takes 30 to 40 seconds. And if there was drink taken, it could be longer. Let's take him up to a minute. By the time you've seen him, you're gobsmacked. By the time you're actually assured yourself of what he's doing, he's 20 seconds in. You know, he'd probably only have about 5 seconds left by the time you open the window to him. So
I didn't time it now.
Yeah.
Unlike our column.
It was so disgusting.
Did you
it
ring
really
anyone?
Was.
Did you? Were you tempted to ring the guards at all?
No, I was actually talking to the guard the next day and I said, you know, I was so tempted to throw a few eggs. Only my eggs were organic. I said, I'm not going to waste them on his car. No. But by the time I came downstairs, anyway, the car was gone.
And away you went. I suppose the other insult is, as you say, you didn't recognise him from around in a small village. The thought that somebody would come specially to your village and the only thing they'd have to offer would be to leave that on your doorstep.
I know.
Oh, and he's not even local. But then on Thursday, do you have to go out farting for the really nice toilet? Here's Frances.
I was in Spain recently, in Alicante, and I went into a shopping mall there. I needed to use the facilities, and they were absolutely pristine. And I did say to her, and I will repeat it, you could actually eat your dinner off the floor. It was so spotlessly clean.
And you were able to, like, shiny tiles and the smell, how would you describe it? Fragrant?
Fragrant. It's a citrusy smell as you go in. It wasn't a nauseous smell. It was absolutely lovely, a fresh, beautiful smell.
You could have spent the rest of your holiday there.
Absolutely.
Eating your dinner off the floor.
Eating your dinner off the floor.
Okay, very good. A bog standard buffet. But anyway,
Oh, Colm, cutting it just for the punning. At the start of the week, Oliver & Co on the road, yes, gentle listener, leaving Montrose for the West Coast. On Monday, it was Donegal.
And now this is South Donegal, so they're very softly spoken around here, not the North Donegal, where it's more harsh and more clipped up there and saying nothing more, no. Donegal, as you know, it's a place that's different from the rest of the country. I think the Ice Age ended here around about, 1995 or so, and global warming is expected in about 1,000 years. And there's a distinctive sense of humour, which I've already been caught off hand at so far. It's a kind of, they tell about three jokes as dry as a Chardonnay every year, and the population very contented once there's no fuss made about anything whatsoever. If a Donegal person kind of burst into bright purple flames, they'd quietly leave the pub for fear of making a show of themselves, you know, that sort of a way. And they don't trust anything too ostentatious, such as umbrellas, or hair gel, or using your whole mouth to speak, because they're decent, deep and quietly proud people.
Ooh, courting potential controversy with the little pen portraits. And of course, no trip to an Atlantic county is complete without this. Here's hotel guru Noel Cunningham.
You go swimming every morning.
I do. I was brought up near Killybegs.
Yeah.
And near fishing ports, you were not encouraged to learn how to swim.
That's right. The superstition of sailors.
Correct. The sea claimed you. And people were going out in little seiners, we called them in those days. And I suppose the belief was that if something happened, you weren't going to survive anyway. So don't prolong the agony.
But don't fight fate, I think, was kind of the superstition.
Let the sea claim you.
Did you learn to swim then growing up? Were you unusually, or did you
absolutely
have to...
not.
Okay. So
I learned to swim. My friend Lisa, bless her, she said, Noel, you are getting in the water during COVID because the beach is right beside my house. And it's been basically a lifesaver because I'm a recovering alcoholic. So yeah, it is really the best way to start the day.
But you live life to the full, don't you?
One has to. I mean, I learned very quickly when I turned 70. There are three ages, young, middle-aged, and you're looking very well, Noel. I just have to work
a bit that age.
Harder at that now. And, you know, I try to embrace the day and say, look, get up, get out.
Brilliant.
And a bit of makeup is required. Go for it, you know.
He'd almost persuade you to get in. Almost. And then on Tuesday, they headed down the coast.
Sligo, you see, was founded by a secret government department as a place for people riddled with notions. It's like a kind of a leper's colony for people who look down on Roscommon or Longford.
Well, you're inclined to get the notions when you've got yourself a queen. Here's Sally Siggins, head guide at Carramore Megalithic Cemetery, on how Maeve was brought low by a lump of gobeen.
She was actually killed, believe it or not, by a piece of cheese. That's a cheesy story for
her. How did she get killed?
Her nephew was taking revenge for her killing his mother, her sister, Clothru. And when all came to a head down in Loch Ree, and he had a slingshot, he couldn't find a stone. We've plenty of them here beside us in Strandhill. But he
couldn't find a stone
at the perfect opportunity. He looked in the lunch bag and he found a big block of cheese, put in the slingshot, hit her over the head, and she drowned in the lake. And then there's three stories after that. One says she's buried in Knockma in County Galway, Maeve's hill. Another is that she's buried in Rathcrohan, and the people in the Tulsk Visitor Centre there in Rathcrohan are very strong that they have her in Rathcrohan. But we're very strong here in Sligo that she's up on Knocknarea in her own tomb with her sword and her shield.
Queen Maeve, left, right and centre here. That was a sad end to a great warrior to be...
Yeah,
sad end,
but I think now,
a bad article,
while a lot of people in Ireland are named after our wonderful warrior queen, she mightn't have been all that good. You know, killing her sister was a bit of a bad deal.
Yeah, so she did murder the sister. That's the kind of crux of the whole thing.
That'll do it for you, in fairness. And then finally, Sligo behind them, they head to Conwy. Tread careful now, sir.
Now, I did a lot of Mayo meandering yesterday, hours and hours of it, to make up for all the things I've done, Slag and Mayo and Indochinny over the years, is like community service. And I'm starting to understand why people are wild and loony about Mayo. 8 o'clock last night, dodged on up to Ciana Uris, that is Erris Head, the very top of the dangly bit. And there's sheep everywhere, quiet as lambs they are. And the field nibbled down to like a pile carpet. So you can stroll very comfortably over the headlands, and you're on the prong of a fork now, which is holding the calm waters of Broadhaven Bay, where the pirates once flourished. I presume there's a nicer name, Osgoelga, there as well. But it's kind of the most incredible sight I've seen for a long time. I think I had a moment of Mayo religion there on the walk. It was pure joy. It would make the Mona Lisa grin, you know, that sort of place. So we know now the beauty has driven the average Mayo man, Asif Yaour, out of his conniptive mind, and the women as well. Well, the women are regular enough. It's the men, they're just a little bit extra mad.
Yeah, we'll take it. And Oliver spoke to Fergus Sweeney. He was at Black Sod Lighthouse on the Erris Peninsula, North Mayo, mind you. And unlike the rest of the county, this lighthouse is square.
We are one of the very few square lighthouses that you will find around the coastline of Ireland. And that's a result of the budget at the time when they came to construct the building. Okay. Yeah, they had £2,440, so they couldn't afford the labour cost to cut your round tower. So they decided to build us square, and we're glad they did.
But it could be a pretty tough life. And if you were on Black Rock Lighthouse, 12 miles out to sea, best chain up the children.
I saw downstairs a thing about hooks for children on the walls of little island rock.
I guess you could have up on, you know, 9 children living on that island for up to 8 months. And of course, the parents were busy. It's maybe 300 metres by 60 metres wide. So they didn't have a babysitting service. So they did the next best thing they could. So they lashed their children onto metal posts around the island. And that way could get on with their work. And, you know, their little children wouldn't disappear off the side of the island, you know.
Certainly practical. Now, Sweeney's grandfather worked at this lighthouse from 1933, and his uncle and father still operate the lighthouse. And it was the weather forecast from Black Sod Lighthouse that determined the date of the D-Day landings. But this wasn't something the family knew for quite a while.
Do you know how long before Maureen Sweeney, your grandmother, realised the importance of what she was, because she sent the message as well, didn't she?
So she doesn't realise that her readings are that last bit of the puzzle for D-Day until 1956.
As late as that?
As late as 1956, when Met Éireann will actually build the Belmullet weather station. Yeah. They come to remove the instrumentation from Black Sod and kind of mention to them in passing, well, you know, guys, Your readings were the crucial readings. They were the last thing the commanders for D-Day had to kind of look at before they could make their final decision. This little weather station on the west coast of Ireland kind of sealed D-Day and guaranteed its success.
Not quite saying Mayo saved the world, but pretty close. But we will end their odyssey with Owen Colgan, and you'll know him from the Hardy books. He gave us this ode to the mullet, Bell Mullet.
The mullet. God, I'd love to touch your hair. It's not fair the way it flows. And what's that around your nose? A tash, no less. I see you keep it very tidy, like a man doing the shopping on a Friday. Do you mind telling me what product you use? A can of beer. I knew it smelt of booze. And oh God, look at that, right there at the back. A mullet, blowing in the breeze, floating like a sneeze. Jesus, tonight it's some sight. 2 inches of luscious locks. Call the cops, because that can't be natural, pal. Hey, before you go, I'd love to know, do you think a man like me could be so cheeky as to grow my own, a mullet I call home? Wait, I never caught your name. Let me guess. Is it James, Graham, or is it Eamon? No. Derek? Yeah, I thought so. Goodbye then, and take care. I'll never forget the mullet man's hair.
On filler, Owen Colgan.
And that brings us to drive time, because when it comes to our cities, is Dublin one of the most livable? It is not, no. Copenhagen, the world's most livable city. All of this according to the Economist Global Livability Index, which has education, infrastructure and stability, amongst other markers. But don't mind all that, says Cormac.
I don't think Irish cities featured in this list at all, which I think is a major faux pas. And this is a serious question. Is it as good an atmosphere as Cork or Galway, let's say, Copenhagen?
That's a good question. One that I've been kind of asking myself as well.
That's Owen O'Sullivan, a journalist living in Copenhagen.
It's undoubtedly a comfortable, nice place. I mean, it's yeah. beautiful, and there's
I see a
it gives
port.
You Copenhagen, yeah, and it gives you and the, all these kind of basic things that are in place for you already give you the kind of space to look after yourself and take care of yourself mentally, and that I think is what brings us up with the general living quality. But there is a slight edge missing in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You can have fun and everything. I mean, it's. I've been here a good while now, and I've certainly had a good time. But there's certainly a bit of a rawness that's missing that you find, you know, Cork,
too
Galway,
decent.
Dublin.
Oh.
Yeah,
too
I think
decent.
So.
No, do you know what he's saying? It lacks the crazy characters that you get on the street in Galway or Cork or other cities.
Yeah, I mean, you can find a few crazy characters in the middle of the night if you go out to Copenhagen, but it's late into the night when you find them.
Oh, those not so crazy Danes. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Mooney Goes Wild, Derek spotted something here in Montrose.
There's lots of birds on the grounds, as you know. One in particular, the magpie, is ever present. But one of them that I noticed is of an individual that's missing its tail. But it seems to be fairly happy out, hopping around the grass as magpies do. And I even saw it flying and I was wondering, how can this be? How can it survive without a tail?
How indeed in this field of dreams? Here's Niall Hatch.
Well, it can still fly because it has wings. So it flaps the wings. That's
yeah, but I know that. Okay.
But the tail is it's helpful for them to be able to steer and stabilise in the air. But they can still fly without it. Perhaps not as efficiently, which is why they evolved it in the first place. But tailless magpie, they can survive pretty well. They're very intelligent birds. They can overcome all sorts of obstacles. And hopefully that tail will grow back before too long. My suspicion is what may have happened there is perhaps a predator like a cat or a fox may have pounced on it. Often it would land on the tail of the bird with the their paws, and birds' tails are often actually they've evolved to break away very quickly, so that those feathers will pull out quite easily, so the bird itself can fly away to safety and then hopefully regrow the tail and live to fight or to fly another day.
Oh, sweet relief. But all of that got them onto tails. Do we need them, and if so, why? And in particular, the tail of the red squirrel. Here's Dr. Richard Collins.
I'm intrigued about the red squirrel. Its tail seems to me to be evolving in the direction of a wing. It's using the tail almost as though a bird will use its wing. It's up there very high in the tiny branches of the tree and it's using the tail aerodynamically. Is this a sign that in millions of years from now we will have winged squirrels and the wing being its tail? But am I fantasizing too much here, am I?
Of course, we already have winged squirrels. There are flying squirrels in the world. They're not true flight. They glide, but they've rather than use their tails to become airborne, they have this big flap of skin that connects their front and their back legs, almost like a big parachute. I remember seeing a flying squirrel in Japan, of all places, a giant Japanese flying squirrel, actually take flight from a tree. And they climb up high, and then they just at dusk, they glide down, and they use their tail to help them steer. And we know with the red squirrel here in Ireland that they use that tail for balance, but also, yes, it does seem to give them that little bit of extra oomph when they're jumping across the branches.
No,
that's
oomph.
That's it. And going across the branch. And of course, what I love about it, but I'm a squirrel obsessive. I absolutely love them.
You're a nut.
The genus for the squirrel, it's Sciurus. Sciurus vulgaris is like the common squirrel. Sciurus is from, it means shade tail, because it was originally thought that they used their big bushy tail to shade their heads from the sun. And that's not the case at all, but that's what was believed. So that's why squirrels called shade tail.
Fascinating stuff, I have to.
Fascinating is right. All on Mooney Goes Wild. On Roots with Sive Downs, this singer, you'll know her, but maybe not quite like this.
Well, there was one that I sang that was recorded by Kieran McMahona. It was about a soldier.
And you're Dolores Keane?
Yes.
Yeah. From Caherlestrand?
Yes.
And you're going to sing a song. What do you call the song?
Soldier, soldier.
Soldier, soldier.
I'm soldier, soldier, will you marry me now? With the hay, with the hoe, with the sound of a drum.
Oh, soldier, soldier, will you marry me now? With the hay, with the hoe, with the sound of a drum. Oh, no fair maid, I couldn't marry you because I have no socks to put on. So she ran to the shop as quick as she could run, with the hay, with the hoe, with the sound of a drum. She bought him the socks of the very, very best, I hear small men, and put these on. Oh, soldier, soldier, will you marry me now, with the hay, with the hoe, with the sound of a drum? Oh, no, fair maid, I couldn't marry you, because I have no shoes to put on.
Oh, cute as a button. And on Bowman on Sunday, more singing, this time from Frank Hart.
You can tell by me feet I'm a limb of the law. The people of Dublin for me have no gra. They hiss me and boo me when I pass them by. Sinn Féin up the rebels, you'll hear them all cry. Now you may think that's bad, but there's one thing that's worse. This grand Irish language for myself is a curse. With a con mavron, you'll hear them all say, on digging to me, and Sinn Féin hooray. Is Doyleum go well, is Doyleum not hey? Octa me egg foul of Angalia.
Pure magic. Part and parcel of an Irish summer, the Galway Arts Festival, and becoming quite the fixture Enda Walsh's rooms. This year it's the turn of the baby's room. He spoke to Sean on Arena.
Yeah, so what the person or the people going into the room get is they're in this about size of an average room, about 5 meters by 5 meters, and there are all the accoutrements that would be in such a room, be it an hotel room or a bathroom or a girl's bedroom, as you had, or the waiting room, I think, was one of the ones that I saw in recent years. All the accoutrements, all the things that would be in those rooms, and you're hearing this voiceover of a person telling you a part, like an event or some very specific moment in their lives. But I'm interested in the nature of the room and the space itself. I mean, it's a confined space. It's just the one. It's just the one voice. That confinement, that physical confinement of the room.
Yeah.
How does it for you? How does it mirror maybe the psychological confinement of the characters and the space that they're in? And how do the two things feed off each other?
Well, everyone knows at this stage my obsession with interiors. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, it probably comes from when I was a little bit of a kid, and, you know, and that feeling of really sort of claustrophobia, but also a slight fear of the outside also. So they're very sort of charged spaces. And yes, it's the relationship that the person has with, I mean, I'll walk into any old room, Sean, and so I will sit there and I'll feel, I mean, you know, it's one of the sort of, you know, superpowers of a playwright, if you can have one, is that actually I can sense sort of a vibe very strongly. And it's that very simple idea that sort of like the walls hold voices and ghosts. And it's literally, it's as simple as that.
But how different is it writing for the stage versus this kind of installation?
I've heard you speak again in previous times about this idea of one of the things that has always attracted you to theatre, for example, and to playwriting, is the fact that you can have a silence on the stage. And a silence on radio is deadly, but a silence on the stage can be an absolutely wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's always about sort of like, I mean, God, I hate myself for saying this, and you know, like, you know, I sound so pretentious, but a lot of the time when I talk to the team about the work that I've worked with for years and years and years, a lot of it is actually just sort of charging that sort of that big silent space with noise and expression and rhythm and, you know, like loudness. But really you want to take all that away and hit these vast moments of sort of like of space. And, you know, and you're constantly playing with that. You're also, you know, throwing sort of words and or images or noise or sort of physical comedy or whatever it is into this thing, only to really sort of take it away and see what's left of the character. You know, there's a lot of that. And these rooms have a similar sort of power in many ways. It's the same sort of, although they're like, they're tiny, they're small, and also they're audio, it's the same sort of thing. It's always about, like, you know, what isn't being said a lot of the time, and, you know, and also just the wild expression of that character. Mm. Why are they talking the way they are? All that sort of thing. And the fact that, of course, they're really ephemeral. They're over. They're over as soon as they sort of started, which I just love.
Of course, you could always go back and revisit a room.
Could you revisit them? Have you ever thought about revisiting one of the characters in a different room or to see how the room has been renovated a few years on?
I haven't, but that's a really, really excellent idea. That's a really good idea. I'll take that and I'll make it my own.
I thought of this.
But that is a very good idea. Do you know what, Sean? At one point, though, I did, like, you know, that, like, a while ago, like, at the very, very beginning, actually, in fairness, that I thought, oh, yeah, of course, I'll get around to knitting them all together at some stage. Oh, yeah. And then I thought, no, because actually, sort of, people don't work like that, really. I mean, to be honest about it, it is that thing, you know, I love Hitchcock's Rear Window and all of that. That lives, sort of, like, watching all those lives sort of at the same time, you know, like, sort of existing. And my dream always was like, and it was like going, okay, I'm going to die, but I'm going to continue to make these. And the idea of sort of like, you know, walking into a giant gymnasium with sort of like 35, 40 rooms sort of existing at the same time is a very, very, very true representation of what goes on in my head all the bloody time. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. That would be, that would be my tombstone. Yeah.
Enda Walsh on Rooms with Sean. And if that's central to the Irish summer, so's the hurling. But before we get into this Sunday's game, a Dublin firm, yes, a Dublin firm, making hurls, hurlies.
And do you say hurley or hurl? This is the debate that'll never be settled, I suppose. Come on, is the only option that you can't get caught out with.
See, but you robbed me now. I was going to say, come on there.
So up in Dublin, it's called a hurl. Down the country, it's called a hurley. Yeah. It's a debate that's never going to be won. It's a hurl or a hurley. Come on is the safe option, I suppose. Yeah, yeah.
That gets you out of trouble if you say
it's,
come on.
It's a compromise. Yeah. A compromise game.
That's Bernard Farrell and his son Dean with the Darcy. And they make hurls, hurleys. Ray got right up in their business.
Do you mind me asking you how many would you make in a day? Or is
it? We'd make probably around 100, maybe 110 a day.
Would you?
Yeah, yeah, we would, yeah. It only takes about 10 minutes to make a hurl. And that's made by hand now.
Yeah, yeah.
That's made by hand.
But that jigsaw you had out in the shed, you've
well gone.
That's well and truly gone. That's well and truly gone.
You're going to
cost a fortune.
We'd have three bandsaws now, two sanders, so it's all done with that. So it speeds up the process.
Yeah.
And we'd work together as a team. We'd do them in batches, so you wouldn't be making one or two at a time. You'd be making batches, say 50, take a break, 50.
Yeah.
So Bernard would be cutting out bandsawing them and I'd be in rough sanding them. And we've another colleague, Michal, who'd be in smooth sanding them as well.
Right.
So it's a real family business. My mother runs the shop. My grandfather goes down and collects the ash. We have a lot of friends involved in the GA. When we're really stuck, they come in and give us a hand as well. So it's like the GA. It's real family orientated. Everyone's really close and we all get stuck in. But it's good.
Family is GA. We're all a family.
You get passion. That's one of the words.
Yeah. You have to have the passion, right? You have to have, especially if you're making holes, you have to have passion. Do you know what I mean? Because some days you'll be in there now and things wouldn't go your way. Or whatever might happen, and you have to say, right, let's just keep it going, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, you could make a hurl for every county and every hand.
Are there specific dimensions that you have to meet?
There is. There's certain guides, like a goalkeeper would have a bigger hurl. There's certain limits you can use. Like you can't use a goalkeeper's hurl outfield, it's too big. It's not fair on the outfield players, you know, that way. So there will be certain limits there, yeah. There's like, loads, there's 40 different shapes as well. You'd have your Wexford shape, Kilkenny shape, Galway shape. So each county has their own shape. Do you know that way?
Didn't know that.
No. So we came up with our own shape. It's called the Dean shape. It's a bit of it. The Dean shape.
Oh, you're
it's my own shape. Yeah,
right,
yeah. So we used, there's a whole name after me. Yeah. So it's a bit of three or four different styles put together. The one that suits me the best.
Right.
So yeah, there's, like, each hurler is very different. Like, I started off playing when I was four. They hadn't got a team for me at that age. I was playing under eights. But you can see now the hurling has come on very good in Dublin. There's a lot of work going in Dublin. Like, a hurley maker will make a round handle for a free taker, certain different unique things for different players you would have.
Right.
So there's a lot goes into it. It's not just the making of a hurl.
No siree, Bob. But come on, Dubs on the hurling this weekend of all. Yeah, Cork v Tip. Sunday, and as is almost obligatory, the cute kids. Brian O'Connell spoke to some Tip fans at Cashel King Cormac's GAA club.
Your sign says there will be no Barry's tea in the Lee McCarthy.
Oh, okay.
Jack, I hear you're kind of a big supporter, right?
I am, very. Yeah, I'm going to it anyway.
Are you?
Yeah, I am.
Jeez, you must have good contacts now to have the ticket in the back pocket already.
I'm Daniel.
I'm Connor Hogan.
And Aoife Hogan.
And Aoife Hogan's.
Shirley Hogan.
And Shirley Hogan, all the Hogans. I'm a bit nervous kind of waiting to see what's going to happen.
Yes.
Give me the score.
321 Tip to 219 Cork.
The anticipation must be huge, is it?
Yeah, it is. Tip have come on so well since last year, and I think everybody is just so proud of Tipperary to get as far as they have this year.
Tell me, have you got your ticket?
No.
Not yet?
No.
What about you?
No.
You were telling me a minute ago, what have you done this week? You've entered...
every single raffle we came across.
And no luck yet?
No.
So Oisin, he always comes down to the field every night and he's like...
I heard he was down here this week.
Yeah, he came down last night and he was in goal for us.
What's he like as a goalie?
Not bad.
What age are you?
7.
What do you think is going to happen on Sunday?
Oisin might make the comeback again. Tip win by 1 point. 1 point.
Now that would be close. But then he went to Cork, Brian O'Connell's native county, and he spoke to Glen Rovers Hurling Club. And they have a lot of skin in the game.
Jack O'Connell.
Kieran O'Connell.
Oliver Burt.
Alex Toomey.
Caoimhe McCarthy.
So tell us about your links then. Who are you related to?
The Downies.
What's it like to have a cousin playing in the All-Ireland on Sunday?
I'm proud of him, like.
Who's going to win on Sunday?
Cork, obviously, like.
What about you?
Cousins with the Downies. They worked hard through the years for it. Yeah, he's up there every day with his hurley. Either training or at the gym.
Alex Toomey, related to Patrick Corgan.
You're related to Patrick Corgan. Is he finally going to get the All-Ireland?
Probably, yeah.
Do you think so?
Hopefully.
Sometimes in sport, it can be very cruel. You don't get your rewards, but you're hoping he gets his reward on Sunday. Will you get a ticket?
Yeah.
The benefits to being a cousin, isn't there?
Yeah.
And yourself?
Caoimhe McCarthy, and Patrick Corgan is my uncle.
He's your uncle. We know what he's like as a hurler, right? What's he like as an uncle? Would there be many tenors in the back pocket?
Sometimes, yeah.
Not bad, yeah.
Just always has a hurley in his hand and always out the back and pucking around and stuff.
They're the things people don't see, aren't they?
Yeah.
Up the Rebels!
Oh, the mega fans. But who dares call it? Turns out, Dunlow, Cusack and Morning Ireland.
Prediction. Overnight, Cork have named an unchanged team to that which defeated Dublin and 14 of the same starting 15 from last year's All-Ireland final. The hurt from losing that final is more than a bad memory. It's the path forward. And with so many carrying that pain in their bones instead of a weight, it should be their fuel. Cork to win. That's it, Hurling Nation. Another season down. Hurling is food for the soul, drink for the imagination and rhythm for the dance. Win Tanavas on Sunday.
Well, in the interest of balance, and we do like an underdog... go Tip. And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Can you catch a medicine ball? Can you catch yourself when you fall? You should be careful.